All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a CW-2 type helicopter pilot in Vietnam, 1969, Sky Chief 20. Yeah, well, I want to welcome everybody to our program today. We're really excited to have you here. We've got a Medal of Honor recipient that we're going to be talking to shortly. But also joining me in the studio, actually co-hosting with me today, is another helicopter pilot. Now, she is an Apache pilot. She is also the executive director of Fisher House, Michigan, and that is Captain, because now I have to salute her before I start talking to her, and that's Kate Melcher. Kate, welcome to the studio, and welcome to helping me out.
Thank you so much. It's my favorite thing to do on a Sunday afternoon.
Right. Like we have nothing else to do. I want to remind everybody that we are sponsored by Legal Help for Veterans. And Legal Help for Veterans is a disability law firm specializing only in veteran disability claims. And if you'd like to give them a call, see what's going on with your claim or how do you appeal it, which seems like the normal case on a regular basis. That's a political announcement. I probably shouldn't have said that, right? But anyway, give Legal Help for Veterans a call at 800-693-4800. Also, we're sponsored by U.S. Wings, which is the home of the finest leather flight jackets in the world. At least that's what Sergeant Hack says, and he owns the company, so he should know. And you could reach him at 800-650-0659. We're also sponsored by the local VVA Chapter 310, that's the Charles S. Kettles chapter here in Ann Arbor. The VFW, Graft O'Hara Post 423, also in Ann Arbor. And American Legion, Irwin Prescorn, Post 46. All of them are from Ann Arbor, and we really thank them all for their continuing support of Veterans Radio. I want to jump back to U.S. Wings real quickly to let everybody know that when our benefits program is coming up on the 31st, and every benefits program that we've been doing since in January, U.S. Wings has been donating an A2 bomber jacket. It's called a Buffalo Leather Jacket. They're worth $200. And if you would like to join, just go to the Veterans Radio website. It's veteransradio.net. And click on the site that says Veterans Radio wants you to win. Please, veterans only. The question this month is, what is your MOS? What was your military specialty while you were in the service? So if you get in there and get your name on there, on the 31st, we will announce who gets to win the jacket from U.S. Wings. So please do that if you can. Ooh, okay, so we've got a few events that are going on, don't we, Kate?
We do. March is a busy month.
Well, tell us about Fisher House's first, and then we'll get on the rest.
Okay. Fisher House has an event on March 31st. It's a Sunday. And for those of you who have been to Knight's Steakhouse over the years, you know they're typically not open on Sundays.
Correct.
Well, Knight's out on Dexter Ave out in Ann Arbor has decided to open up specially for a spaghetti dinner. Bethlehem United Church of Christ is the co-host, and they're providing volunteers. There are student vets that are coming from the University of Michigan that are helping to serve. There are two seatings available. You can get tickets for $20 per adult. First seating is from 1 to 3 p.m. Second is 3:30 to 5:30. If you've got kids under the age of 11, it's just $10 per child. And, of course, it's Knight's, so there's a cash bar.
Okay. Well, yes. And where do we get these tickets?
You can call the church, 734-665-6149. That's Bethlehem United Church of Christ here in Ann Arbor. Their phone is 734-665-6149. And if by any chance you don't get it together to call ahead of time, they will have some tickets available at the door. $20 per adult, $10 per child. And in addition to some great spaghetti that Don Knight is going to cook up for us, we're also going to have some veteran storytellers talking about their experience and the importance of Fisher House and the latest and greatest of what's going on with our cause.
Oh, tell us a little bit about your cause. How are things going?
Well, your listeners are going to be among the first to hear some really, really exciting news. As you all know, There are Fisher houses all around the world, but there are none here in Michigan. And with our 650,000 veterans and service members that are resident here, we desperately need Fisher houses so that our men and women can access the care that they've earned. So our organization is raising $20 million to bring those Fisher houses here. Until earlier this week, we had raised $4.5 million, and I'm here to tell your listeners that we've now raised $5.5 million.
Wow.
We had an incredibly generous gift come from a corporate donor, and I'm not at liberty to tell you who that is yet, but this corporate donor feels so strongly about having a Fisher House in Detroit that they've restricted their gift for Detroit.
So, wow, that's terrific. If we had a cheering sound, we would
yay!
Wow.
I've been on cloud nine. And so every chance I get, I want to brag about what not just this corporate donor did, but everyone who has been a part of the cause. Mm-hmm. We've got donors that send us a single dollar every single month. And it just warms my heart to know that this is such an important mission that people are willing to be a part of it any way they can.
I think it is terrific, obviously, and especially with the two Fisher houses. We'll be catching up with some of the other parts of the country. But just the idea of providing a place where these families can stay. I know that when we did our program at another radio station, we used to meet before the program up at the old Big Boy that used to be up on Plymouth Road every Saturday mornings when we did that. And there were invariably veterans in there, and we're saying, "What are you doing out here?" And we say, "Well, we have to stay out here over at wherever the motels and hotels were." I said, "Yeah, we got a discount, but it's really inconvenient."
Right.
And so forth. And, we can't cook our meals and so on and so forth. So when they get the opportunity, when the Fisher House does open, they can do what while they're there?
Well, a Fisher House is a brick and mortar support system. Mm-hmm. There are 16 private family suites in a house, but the families have their private area, but everything else is common. So they can cook their meals, they can do their laundry. And these families that break bread together, they've recreated the military family that we all know and love and honestly miss. Mm-hmm. So they'll be staying right next to the VA hospital, able to access their loved one that's in inpatient care. And they get to be with a military family that oftentimes we don't see outside a VFW post.
Right. Yeah. I think that's one of the really the strongest reason, I think, for all of us out there to make donations to the Fisher House to get this thing built.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we just have to find a corporate donor out here for the Ann Arbor House. And so we'll work on that one as we go along.
Well, that one I can tell you about as well. This is a little sneak preview. So today is St. Patrick's Day, but starting on May 1st, we're going to be doing another match period. And because there's a corporate donor who is putting up $500,000 and asking Michiganders to match it. So from May 1st until June 30th, we'll be doing our Memorial Day match. Mm-hmm. And there's $500,000 to match dollar for dollar. Every dollar you send in will be doubled during that match period.
I just thought of another fundraiser we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's great. That's great. Well, there are other events going on around our county here in Ann Arbor, and these are for veterans as well. And so I'm going to actually, if we do this chronologically, I think that yours goes first.
Okay, so the Fisher House event is March 31st. Remember to get your tickets. The soonest event that's coming up is on March 22nd, next Friday. VCAT-9, for those of you who aren't familiar with that acronym, it's the Veterans Community Action Team. VCAT-9 here in a seven-county area is the most active in the state, and they want to do everything they can to connect veterans to the resources that they've earned and to celebrate their service. That's what we're doing on Friday, March 22nd. At USA Hockey out there in Canton, they're having dinner at 5 o'clock, and the hockey game is at 7 p.m. Dinner and beverages are included, free parking. There's a resource fair. You'll get to see our folks from Fisher House out there as well. There's a kid zone, prizes for kids. There's also additional USA Hockey tickets that are up for grabs. They wanted you to RSVP by March 15th, but as of the airing of this show, tickets are still available. So far, we've got about 2,000 veterans and their family members that are going to turn out for USA Hockey. It's a great night. I did it last year. It's so fun. Mm-hmm. They had face painting for the kids and everything else. If you have any questions about it, you can email march22salute@gmail.com, march22salute@gmail.com, or call 734-453-8000. 8,400. This is at the USA Hockey Arena. It's on Beck Road north of M14 in Plymouth, Friday, March 22nd.
Sounds like a great event. Sounds like it'll be really fun.
It's a lot of fun every year.
You get to drop the puck right there, right?
Yeah.
As they say. Well, they're also sponsoring another activity that is coming up, and this is VCAT9, the Veterans Community Action Team. And it's a Veterans Entrepreneurship and Employment Expo that's going to be at Washtenaw Community College on Friday, March 29th. And this runs from 9 until 1 p.m. at the Morris Lawrence Building over at Washtenaw Community College. The event is free and open to anyone. However, registration is required. And so what they want you to do is to go to this. Whoa, this is a weird website number here. all right, I'll do this. It's https://bit.ly/2HFFWFE. We're going to put this up on our website. I can't remember it, so I'm sure you won't be either able to remember it either. But actually, if you go to the contact the Entrepreneurship Center over at WCC, and I'll bet you they have information for you.
Yeah. The other way to do this, all of these VCAT9 events are available on their social media. If you follow VCAT9 on Facebook, all of these links are clickable. The dates are there, all the information, and registration links. That way you don't have to remember all the dots and dashes and everything else Dale was trying to get to you.
I can't even see it. So too much information there. But I've been to this one. I was there last year. And this is a great opportunity for all you veterans out there that are looking for work, because there's going to be many, many potential employers there, and they want to hire veterans. They know that veterans make good workers. They know that we can follow instructions. They know that we can go to Plan B if Plan A doesn't work, and that we are very flexible. And that the other thing is that we're loyal and we show up for work. So head on out to the Veterans Entrepreneurship and Employment Expo at WCC. That is on Friday, March 29th. And as Kate pointed out, if you go to their Facebook page, it's 9VCAT. That's the number 9VCAT on Facebook. All the information is there. So be there, be square, as they say. All right, we're going to take a real quick break. And when we come back, our guest is going to be here, and that's Alan Lynch. And he's a Medal of Honor recipient for the during the Vietnam War. And we're really excited to talk with Alan, and it's going to be a great story. So stay tuned here. Oh, I got one thing I forgot to tell you. We broadcast from the studios of WAAM 1600 AM here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, but WAAM now has a sister. They've got an FM station. WAAM FM, I'm assuming, is going to be it, and you can listen at 92.7. That's 92.7 WAAM.FM, and this means that the signal will go further west, and it won't go away in the dark. Like sometimes the AM signal kind of drops down a little bit. So we encourage you out there, if you are listening in the local audience, check out the FM station while we take this break. You might be interested in that. All right, we're going to be back shortly with Alan Lynch, and you're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Army Specialist Alan Lynch saved three men in the face of hostile fire, then defended his position alone for more than 2 hours. Details after this. While serving in the forward element of an operation in Vietnam, Lynch's unit became heavily engaged with a numerically superior enemy force. Observing three wounded comrades lying exposed to enemy fire, Lynch dashed across 50 meters of open ground through a withering hail of enemy fire to administer aid. Reconnoitering a nearby trench for a covered position to protect the wounded from intense hostile fire, he killed two enemy soldiers at point-blank range. With the trench cleared, he unhesitatingly returned to the fire-swept area three times to carry the wounded men to safety. When his company was forced to withdraw by the superior firepower of the enemy, Lynch remained to aid his comrades at the risk of his life rather than abandon them. Alone, he defended his isolated position for 2 hours against the advancing enemy. Using only his rifle and a grenade, he stopped them just short of his trench, killing five. Again, disregarding his safety in the face of withering hostile fire, he crossed 70 meters of exposed terrain five times to carry his wounded comrades to a more secure area. Once he had assured their comfort and safety, Lynch located the counterattacking and friendly company to assist in directing the attack and evacuating the three casualties.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we want to welcome to our program the Medal of Honor recipient you just heard about, and that is Alan Lynch. And Alan, we want to welcome you to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you. I know after reading your book, the reason that we're talking to Alan today is that his book just was published on the 13th of March, and it's entitled Zero to Hero. And in the book, you talk about, and we'll get to this a little bit later, but you talk about that the Army's recollection of your events on that particular day and your recollections don't necessarily jive. Is that true?
Pretty much, yeah.
Well, I want to talk to you about the book. It was a great read, and I wanted to know, why did you finally sit down and decide to write this autobiography?
I had kind of a weird, unique experience with, my life. I'm not the typical hero. I was bullied a lot when I was in grade school and a little bit in high school, not as much as grade school and junior high, but pretty much in junior high and grade school, I was beaten up a lot. So I was a lousy student and, I didn't excel in any athletics. In fact, in high school, I avoided all athletics and avoided everything. So I'm not the, I lettered in 15 things and, was a track star and all that kind of stuff, and I wasn't a straight A student, so I'm kind of the atypical recipient.
But the story, actually, let's tell our audience a little bit about your story of starting out life in Illinois.
Yeah, I was born in Roseland, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago, blue collar. Really a great place. When I was a kid, we walked about four or five blocks to school when I was 5 years old. I mean, you do that today and they'd probably throw you in jail.
Right.
True.
But back then you could walk that far to school. I used to walk to school and actually walk home for lunch when I was in kindergarten and first grade. And it was a great time. And then we moved to a little place called, Homewood, Illinois, which is a suburb a little bit farther south. And again, I lived in a trailer camp and it was an amazing, amazing time to be a boy because you could go out and do all kinds of stuff and have adventures and, the stuff that if you did it today would cause a real problem. But back then we were able to roam around and have fun and just be kids.
I can agree with you since we're the same age. I understand the idea of walking home for lunch was a great thrill at the time, and I didn't realize it. But we could go out and play, and it was it's kind of sad that they can't have the same adventures, I guess you could say, that children of 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago had today. I think they're missing out on a lot. So tell me about all right. So you had problems with bullies all the way through school, you said.
Well, we moved to Lake Eliza, Indiana. I went to a country school, and if you know anything about the country, unless you're like three generations, you're a new kid.
Right.
And so the first couple of years, I started off in third grade. It was a great year, had a lot of fun. I wasn't the most popular kid, but I wasn't unpopular. Had a good time through most of fourth grade, and then three bullies came in. Now, my mom was a pacifist, and I was kind of a big kid because I was held back because of health reasons when I was younger. And so I was a big kid, and these kids came to school, and they just started to make my life a living hell. And, I wanted to fight them, but my mom said, what if you hurt somebody? What if you knocked out? I don't know why moms always say that. It always has to do with an eye somewhere. So what happened, to make a long story really short, I let fear have a place inside of me, and it grew like a cancer, and I became afraid not only of hurting them, but of being hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the other mothers never bothered to tell their kids that. So, you know, here I am. What's weird about it is I'm getting beat up all the time. Fat lips, bloody nose, the whole nine yards. And my eye ain't falling out.
You didn't lose your eye, luckily.
So, I never, you know, it never occurred to me that here I am. I'm getting beat up. I'm getting all of this stuff happened to me. And I'm not fighting because I'm so afraid of hurt, you know, not only hurting them, but being hurt. Then it came more of being hurt that I just turned into a total complete, you know, wreck when I was in grade school and junior high. You know, back then it was seventh and eighth grade.
Right. Yeah. It's just like a vicious circle that you ran yourself yeah. into. So tell me about, you know, you mentioned that your mom was a pacifist. Tell me a little bit about your father. I know he's a hard worker. That's for sure.
Yeah, my dad was one of these guys that if you get hit, you hit back, mm-hmm. and you hit back harder. And he told me, I don't know how many times, if you bloody one of them, if you hurt one of them, they're going to leave you alone. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I'd go to school, and I'm like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to hit them today. I'm going to do it today. And then something would happen, and I'd freeze.
Mm-hmm.
I'd just freeze. And it went on like that, you know, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, and seventh and eighth grade were just really a nightmare.
You know, it sounds like this was really formative in terms of building your self-esteem. And as I was reading about early on in your military career, it actually was holding you back from opportunities. Is that the case?
Well, pretty much. I went to, I was doing pretty good in basic training. And I think it was about the sixth or seventh week that a bunch of us got called down, and we were given the opportunity to change our MOS from, I was going to be a clerk typist. And they said, well, if you go 11B infantry, you can go to OCS and become an officer. And I thought, boy, I can finally make my mom and dad proud of me. So I went to infantry basic training or infantry AIT at Fort Gordon, Georgia, and leadership school and all of that. And I was given a couple opportunities in basic to be a squad leader, and then the same thing in AIT to be a squad leader. And, you know, I lasted a couple weeks doing that, but, you know, I was still very immature. When I went to OCS, all of that stuff about being picked on came back. You know, suddenly it was, they're out to get me. It's happening to everybody else the exact same way, but they're paying particular attention to me, and that was kind of the immaturity coming out. So I was right back to being that bullied little kid again.
Well, Kate, you went through OCS, so you can relate to this probably a little bit.
I did, absolutely. And you'll have to forgive me. Sorry, I didn't introduce myself at the beginning of this. I've been diving into your story, and I'm fascinated by this process. I ended up as a captain in the Army, but I went to basic training just like everyone else and found myself selected for leadership there. And I did go on to OCS and found myself selected for leadership there. And the whole time, I was doubting the wisdom of the Army for making those selections.
Yeah.
I, that me? Really?
Are you kidding?
Right. You know, it was excellent training, but, you know, hearing you talk about a lack of self-esteem and you know, wondering, you know, why am I being chosen for these slots? It's resonating with me.
It is. So we've got about 3 minutes, Alan, before we got to take a break with the news. So I guess we'll go in. You joined the Army to give yourself some confidence, correct?
Yeah. You know, it was back in 64. And as you know, with young men, there was only three places you went. You went to college, trade school, or you got drafted.
Mm-hmm. That is very true.
I was not interested in the trades. I certainly was not going to college because I barely graduated. So there was only one place to go. And rather than wait, I decided to take things into my own hands and enlist. And it was one of the best decisions I ever made.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about your experiences in basic training. How did that mold you? I know personally, I thought it was one of the best things I ever did also.
Oh, yeah. I got in shape. I learned how to live with other men of different places. You know, I'm a white kid from a white neighborhood. You know, the closest I came to a black person was, you know, if I saw him on the bus or the train, if I went down to the loop or something. But in basic, my platoon sergeant was Sergeant Wright. He was an African-American airborne guy, real straight. He was like Lou Gossett, an officer and a gentleman. And this guy's crap.
Yeah, we all had those.
And he made it very clear that he didn't care who we were, where we came from. We were going to work as a team. And we did. Yeah. We learned how to do all of the stuff that you're supposed to do. And we had a lot of bigots, you know. I mean, this is 64, and there's still a lot of racism going on. And they learned, you know, the bigots, black and white, you know, we learned how to get along. Because we found out very quickly, if Drill Sergeant Wright wasn't, or Sergeant Wright wasn't happy, nobody was going to be happy.
Okay.
We made that very clear to us.
They certainly do, and they always seem to be the tallest and the strongest people in the world. But we're going to take a quick break here, Alan. We're talking with Alan Lynch, Medal of Honor recipient during the Vietnam War. He is author of a new book entitled Zero to Hero, From Bullied Kid to Warrior. So we encourage you to stay tuned as we switch around to the other side of the news. We're going to come back and see how he actually earned this Medal of Honor. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Veterans Radio here, and we are talking with Medal of Honor recipient Alan Lynch. Also joining me in the studios is a helicopter pilot herself, Captain Kate Melcher. And Kate and I are here talking with Alan about his Medal of Honor. We just found out a little bit about his background. His book is entitled Zero to Hero, From Bullied Kid to Warrior. And I know that a lot of people out there can relate to that story. I think that, Alan, what you were mentioning about basic training was how it takes... It took a lot of us, and there were a lot of guys in my platoon, like you mentioned in the book. There are great stories about the people that you ran across, and they go from, you know, from Nowhereville town, you know, to New York City, and it's such a learning experience.
Yeah, it was one of the best in my life.
Yeah, I mean, you finally figured out what was going on in the rest of the country, I think, you know.
Yeah.
Because we were so isolated wherever we grew up. But... All right, so we went through basic training, and then you decided to try OCS, and that didn't work out so much. But you did end up. Where did you go after you left OCS?
I went from OCS to Gilhausen, Germany, and then I reenlisted on April 25th, 1966. I took a short enlistment, what they called a short enlistment, and I went to Berlin, Germany, and I served in Berlin, Germany, until I volunteered for Vietnam and left Berlin April of 67.
What did you do in Berlin? I'm always interested about the people that got to serve there. I asked to go there, but they didn't send me.
Well, I did. I went and I trained infantry, and of course they put me in mortars.
Oh, of course.
And I absolutely hated it, and I copped an attitude. Again, my maturity coming out.
Yes.
And so in Berlin, I got two Article 15s, one for telling my squad leader what I thought of them, and the other one for going AWOL. And actually, I had a good reason for going AWOL. One of my buddies, who was a bit of a bigot, got a bad letter from home and, you know, said some pretty threatening things. So me and another guy went out to see if we could get him, and we found him at a guest house that we used to hang out at. Of course, we had to have a couple of beers before we got them.
Sure, while you're there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, why not?
And, so
the upstart of the whole thing is I got another Article 15. My buddy got another Article 15. And he walked away free because he had a letter that said, see, this is why I went crazy. You know?
Oh, okay. All right. So Germany wasn't the greatest place for you to go. But all right, so now you decided you're going to go to Vietnam. And when did you get to Vietnam, and who were you assigned to?
I got to Vietnam May 31st, 1967. And for the first time in my military career, I actually got what I was told I was going to get. I volunteered for the 1st Cavalry Division. I got that. And I volunteered for infantry, and I got that. Which made me very happy. I wanted to go to Vietnam. I wanted to get that stink of being pushed around in school off of me. I still felt like I was a coward. I felt like Vietnam was the place to prove myself. And, I got infantry and was air mobile with, of course, the best unit in Vietnam.
I won't go there. all right. So, tell us, you got out into the field right away.
Yeah, pretty much we hit Cameron Bay. I think we spent like 1 or 2 days there, and we flew into An Khe, and where I first got shot at. As our plane was getting to land, a couple of Viet Cong decided to welcome us with some rounds. So we did a combat landing, which is really interesting to do if you were ever on a C-130 in that kind of a situation.
Yes.
got assigned to the CAV, and they put us in, I think, 3 or 4 days of, this is Vietnam school, learned how to rappel a little bit, and then right out to the unit.
And then right out to the field.
Right out to the field, yeah. Went from Camp Radcliffe and An Khe up to LZ English, and the very same day we hit LZ English, we were on another Huey out into the field with what we used to call hot green grass. It was chow.
Mm-hmm.
And resupply and stuff like that. And I was assigned to a squad and ended up getting to the South China Sea. And everybody else went swimming except us new guys. And we were put on guard duty with some of the old timers.
Of course, yeah. New guys are always the one that get guard duty.
Yep.
You came across probably one of the most traumatic events, I think, in your life is when your friend was shot. By friendly fire. Could you kind of tell our audience a little bit about that?
Yeah. Jerry came in country with me, and he was probably one of the best men I ever knew. He was one of those guys that, if you were tired and he was in your foxhole, you could wake him up. He'd stand guard with you. You know, he'd share his last cigarette. You know, just a good guy. He almost died twice before getting to Vietnam. He was struck by lightning, or almost struck by lightning, ended up in the hospital, and then he was kicked in the head by a horse.
Oh, my gosh.
And he always used to tell the story of, you know, 3 strikes and you're out. And he would tell the story, and he'd have us cracking up because I think he added a little bit to it each time, you know, about how it happened and all that. And he and I just had lunch, and, you know, he was from Wisconsin. I'm from Illinois, and we're talking about fishing and all of that. And we start moving down the trail. Our point man gets moving to our front. We get into, you know, a quick, you know, hasty fighting positions. And Jerry gets behind this big tree in a bush. And I got behind a pretty good sized stump. And this guy, John, he was behind us a little bit. And John was one of these guys who never listened to anybody. He was a smart mouth kid. And you know, not a good soldier. Why anybody put him on a machine gun as an assistant gunner is beyond me. But we found out that they were special forces with CIDG, civilian indigenous personnel, mountain yards. And, you know, we all cease fire. They're friendly. I stood up, Jerry stood up, and John shot him.
Jeez.
And when he shot him, he hit one round, the machine gun jammed because it was so filthy.
Oh.
And so had it been the enemy, we'd have been in deep trouble.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
But Jerry got it right in the chest, right above his heart, as I remember. And we got him medevaced out. They didn't tell me that he was dead for quite a few days because some things were said. And when they did tell me, you know, over the course of this time, I was told what a great guy Jerry was. And, you know, it kind of talked me down a little bit, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And when I found out Jerry was dead, it really hit me because he died on the helicopter
right
on the way in. Never made it to surgery. So and I'm glad they didn't tell me. John rehabilitated himself. He was not taken out of the field back then. We didn't do that. He was ostracized pretty much, as I recall. We didn't talk to him and didn't, you know, we didn't give him, you know, an ass whooping, excuse me.
Right.
But as far as, from what I remember, we did nothing with him. We didn't, so he had to earn his way back in. When I left Vietnam, he was a squad leader.
Okay. Yeah. In your book, you mentioned, we're talking with Alan Lynch here, Medal of Honor recipient, whose book is called Zero to Hero, A Bullied Kid to Warrior. And we've just gotten him into Vietnam, where a good friend of his was killed by friendly fire. And in the book, you mentioned how you thought that this John was rehabilitated, and that you really didn't, as you said, you didn't go after him. And you didn't necessarily forgive him, but you also let him reprove himself, if that's a word.
Yeah, he had to earn his way back in, and he became a good, you know, a good soldier. I got pulled out of the field, I think, sometime in January because of the medal. And when I left, I heard he made sergeant and was leading a squad up in I Corps.
Well, rehabilitation.
I want to leave it at that. I want him to have. My hope is that he lived a life that Jerry couldn't.
Right, and I think that's what a lot of us feel when we finally get home and we do realize that, you know, that we made it, that we have to live our life for the people that didn't, and I think that's something that you point out in your book as well. I don't want to run out of time today, so I'm going to jump you forward to December of 1967. Let's talk about that day when you earned the medal.
Okay.
So what happened?
Well, we air assaulted in. It's A Company got hit pretty heavy, and so we air assaulted in. And we were going. As I understood it, we were supposed to hit them from the side, hit the enemy from the side to relieve the pressure on A Company. And what happened is we walked into a three-sided boxed ambush.
Mm-hmm.
Now I had a brand new lieutenant. I think he was a first lieutenant. I don't even know. I don't remember. You know, if he was first or second. What I do know is I had him for about 3 hours. I was his RTO, radio telephone operator. And as we started to move into the area, we got hit. And he ran up towards the front. I followed him. And as things were going down, one of our point men, Irving Wilhelm, came running back, got about halfway between us and got hit. I ran out to get him. And as I recall, a medic came out at some point. We got him back. He said, told me Sergeant Casares had been hit, was walking a two-man point, and he got hit in the shin, so he couldn't move. He couldn't leave. And so I figured, well, I'll drop the radio, and I told the LT, I'm going to drop the radio and go get him. And he said, sure, go ahead, get going. So I dropped the radio, went down, ran across, I don't know how many yards or meters it was, and crawled down the ditch to him, and he was not doing too well. His, you know, his shins seemed to be, you know, shattered because I guess the machine gun they walked into was just, you know, right at that height. I'm trying to figure out how to get him and his M16 and my M16 back to our friendly lines, and Joe Esparza comes running across. I didn't know these two guys back then. I did a lot of research and found out who they were and all that. And Joe got partway to us, got hit. I went out and got him and got him into the ditch with us. And there we stayed. And they tried to get to us a few times. And the hard part about writing this book and the hardest part about writing this was I did a lot of research. I looked at after action reports. I looked at my captain's journal, which I have had for years, but I never read it. I just didn't want to revisit. So as I was reading it and going through it, a lot of the stuff that I remember, it was like, oh, I'm not nuts. I did. That is what happened.
Right. That's one of the advantages sometimes of talking to other veterans. You find out, oh, I really did do that? Oh, holy smokes. How about that?
So what I found out was my lieutenant, we started getting a lot of heavy fire, so they pulled back. And then Captain Orsini, who was an amazing company commander, tried to do a rescue mission to us. He got some volunteers. My new LT was one of them. They came out to try to get to us. The fire got real heavy. They started yelling, how many in the trench? And I said, there's three of us. And we, yelling back and forth and all that. Unbeknownst to me, one of our guys got wounded, and Lieutenant Sutherland, Donald Sutherland, got hit in the head, killing him.
Oh.
And I found his body. I actually found his body pretty much where I had left him.
Mm-hmm.
So then they tried again. It didn't work. That's when they yelled for me to just leave the wounded and go back. And I just couldn't do that. You don't leave your wounded. And I told them what they could do with it. And, kind of stayed there. And Lord knows I wanted to leave.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You got to do it. We don't leave our wounded. You're taught that basic training all the way through.
Right.
So I stayed with them. Then the thing that just tore us apart was they backed up an APC. Captain Orsini was acting as TC, commander, track commander. And so they're backing up the track. They get hit by an RPG. Orsini flies out of the turret. Wounded pretty bad. He actually came back to be the company commander a few months later, but that ended it. There were no more rescue attempts. They called an artillery and airstrikes on us, and then it got quiet, and I went out and reconnoitered the area to make sure there was no VC hanging out or NBA hanging out, and then got them to a safe place, and I was just going to kind of do a half circle until I found our guys. Well, I made one little pass, and there they were.
Wow. So how long were you in that ditch?
Well, they had it at a couple hours, but, we had just finished noon chow, and it was light, and it was dark when I finally got everybody back.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we were there about 4 hours, maybe a little bit less, maybe a little bit more.
Wow. That's really an amazing story that you were able to maintain control of yourself. The flight instinct didn't kick in, and I think that's, that was probably the turning point for you. And I know Kate has a question for you.
Sure.
I do. I mentioned, sir, before that I served post 9/11, so from 05 to 13, and a lot of us in the post 9/11 generation have been called hero, and nearly every single one of us probably squirms at that. We were fortunate enough to serve in a time when our country was 100% behind us, and your generation certainly was not. But you've named your book Zero to Hero. And talking to you, a Medal of Honor recipient, I'd like to hear what you think when someone calls you hero.
I really don't like it too much. What I did, anyone in my company would have done. I'm absolutely convinced that, look, I was only in combat about 7 months by the time they yanked me out of the field, maybe even eight. But I saw guys run out under enemy fire to get wounded. So we were a strike, we were good people, we were good guys, and, I had a hard time dealing with this, especially trying to come to terms with what my citation says and what I remember. And I think words mean things. And I think when we overuse a word just to make someone feel good, we do a disservice not only to that person, but also to the word itself. So when someone calls me a hero, it's like, yeah, I wear this medal, and yeah, that makes me a hero in that sense. But there's a lot of people, as you well know, in special operations, people do stuff like this almost routinely when they're in the bush. They don't get recognized for it because they're in special ops.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir.
You have people that have been in combat, that have done things that nobody sees or nobody writes up, or for whatever reason, they put you in for this big medal and then it gets downgraded. I had one of the cases I had when I was working veteran claims was a guy was put in, I think, for a Distinguished Service Cross, and because he got drunk, they knocked it down to a Bronze Star. And it's like, you know, really? But see, that was the Army of the 1960s. That we, you know, if you go back even further, there was a lot of racism. So people that did brave things that were of color, a lot of times were not given that award. In fact, you know, recently and over the last, you know, 20, 30 years, we've seen a lot of African Americans and Latinos and so on get the Medal of Honor. They should have had it, you know, 35, 40, 50 years ago.
Right. And speaking of which, you received the Medal of Honor back in 1970. The Medal of Honor recipients that I've had the honor to meet have received them recently for service in Vietnam. And watching them evolve into that role, because as a Medal of Honor recipient, you do have a special place in our hearts and in our community and in the veteran space. But I wonder what the evolution of this award has meant since 1970 for you.
It, you know, when I'm in my 20s, I was a different person. It always held a special place. I've always tried to live up to it. When I worked for the VA and for veterans all my life, I think it really hit me when I got to work with the Attorney General's office in Illinois Attorney General's office, and I was allowed to handle appeal cases. And it was, this is where I could really pay back. And this is where, in my mind, I really, you know, I, in a sense, I earned it again, because I got to fight the VA on a lot of cases that had been denied over and over. I only was allowed to take appeals, and I was really good at winning.
Mm-hmm. And bless you for that.
Yes, there are many of us out there that could have used your help. We've got about 10 minutes left. I want to get to your life after you were taken out of the field, which I just found out we had a Medal of Honor recipient here in our local area who said shortly he got his as a pilot, and he said shortly after I was had the event where I was going to receive a medal, he says they took me out of the field. He said, you know, because they didn't want me to get, you know, injured or anything along those lines. And he said, yeah, but that's what I do. That's my job. And I'm sure in your book you put that felt the same way. I don't want to, you know, be pulled out of the field.
Yeah.
But you came home, and let's talk a little bit about your life after you came home, and then we want to get to your foundation at some point.
Okay. Well, I came home and I started to work with the VA shortly after I got the medal. Before that, I had worked for Libby McNeil and Libby as I was a made Vienna sausage. I worked at the State Packers Union, and then I was a management trainee. And then they gave me the medal, and they said I could come to work for the VA. So I did that, and I worked for the VA for 12 years as a benefits counselor, and then at a VA hospital. I got to work with a lot of Vietnam returnees at the Great Lakes Naval Base, and file their claims and all of that. And then when I left the VA, I was starting to have issues with PTSD, and they were getting pretty bad. And I was getting very angry at a lot of stuff. And I was given an opportunity. I was in Hawaii, actually, and we're talking about this Vietnam Veterans Leadership Program. And Leo Thorsness, who was a POW from Air Force POW, was shot down and went to the Hanoi Hilton and paid a lot of dues there. I asked him about it, and he got me in touch with people. So I left the VA and became the executive director of the Vietnam Veterans Leadership Program, helping Vietnam vets get jobs. And what we tried to do is to erase the stigma of the Vietnam vet as a loser and all of that. The PTSD I had would come in like waves. I would, as long as I was busy, as long as I was working, as long as I was doing stuff, things were pretty good. I still had issues, but not nearly as bad. And then when I'd get some downtime, a lot of the demons would come back. And I was kind of a jerk. PTSD makes us focus in on ourselves, and we get to a point where it's all about us. It's all about me, what I want, how I feel, and my nightmares, my dreams, my problems, my this, mm-hmm. my that. And you do that at the expense of everyone around you that loves you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing that. And finally, and I think it was, I got a job with the Attorney General's office. I got into doing appeals. I was doing real well. And then I'd read these medical records and these action reports, and I'd dive even deeper into issues. I was drinking way too much and doing a lot of negative stuff. And finally, I started getting therapy. And she turned me around. It was the hardest work I ever did.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go into PTSD therapy with the idea I'm on a ghost.
Yeah. you have to admit that you have some issues going on. I think I know that's the hardest thing to do.
Yeah. Go ahead. You know, the thing is, and when I went into it, I had worked in the VA, and I know the VA loves to use drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Having worked in the era of Thorazine and Stelazine and all of the other stuff, I'd watched, you know, veterans come in with problems and turn into zombies. I didn't want that. So I told my therapist, I said, I'll do everything you say because I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, but I'm not taking any drugs, not taking any medication. So cure me or fix me or we'll figure it out. Well, I had other plans, you know, if she couldn't help me out. And
we won't go there.
Yeah. And, she did. I worked very hard. The culmination came when I went to visit Jerry's grave in Warren, Wisconsin. I think in the book I call it Warrensville, but then I remembered it was Warren, of course, after it was edited into press.
Right.
And, but I went out and I visited his grave one day, and it was just like all of a sudden, things started to change. I wasn't there yet, but things started to change.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to, the nice thing about the job I had is I was able to close my door. So if I got to a place where I couldn't be around people, didn't want to be, I could just, working on a case, close the door and be left alone, which I need the solitude.
Mm-hmm.
And make a long story short, my mom and dad got pretty sick in the mid and late 90s, and I, by accident, as I was, you know, concentrating on taking care of them, my symptoms all but went away. I was still having them, but they all but went away. And that's when I put on my challenge coin, others, not self. It was right after my mom passed, and I said, you know what, that's my key. That's how I get over this, is I focus on other people.
I think that's
and then
there.
I put the rotary four-way test as my moral compass. I wish I would have done that in the 70s.
So there's a lot of things we wish, many of us wish we had done in the 70s. Probably would have helped us out. We've only got about 2 minutes left, Alan, and I want you to talk about your foundation, if you can, please.
Sure. We decided to, a friend of mine, John Schwan, who's a Vietnam vet, first Cav, we see a lot of veterans falling through the cracks, especially, you know, the war on terror veterans. They were coming home. The ones severely wounded were being taken care of pretty good. You know, people were building houses, buying them cars. The problem was, is the veteran that came home that fell through the cracks, that had too much month at the end of the money. So what we wanted to do was to help them out. So it's what we did is we formed the Alan Lynch Medal of Honor Veterans Assistance Foundation, which is now the Alan Lynch Medal of Honor Veterans Program under Operation Support or Troops America. But what our whole thing is we want to give veterans a hand up, not a handout. We want to help them in education. We don't take care of anyone that is just looking for a handout. We don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're looking to get their life together, we can do things like we have a program that we partnered with the Utility Workers Union, where we can get, you know, veterans in the Chicago area, especially now it's even starting in Michigan and some other states, where they take veterans, train them up, and then they get a job at the end.
Well, that's going to be our goal. Alan Lynch, thank you very much for being on our program. The book is Zero to Hero. I want to talk to you off the air at some point, find out more about your foundation and things that maybe we can do here in Michigan to improve that. So thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Kate, we did it. All right, there's another one. in the can, as they say. So the book is Zero to Hero. It's Alan Lynch. It's a bullied kid to a warrior. Great, just a great story. Very emotional and all those different things. Kate Melcher, thank you very much for being my co-host today. I'm hoping you'll come back.
Always a pleasure.
All right. So until next week, you are dismissed.